The Way Out Podcast, episode 252. What is your name?
Kylie Butler is my name.
Kylie, what was your primary substance of choice?
Alcohol was my primary substance and first love, although I had some fun and games with some other substances as well, but alcohol was it.
You and me both, sister. What is your clean or sober date?
It is 3 years today, actually.
Are you kidding me? Hot.
Oh, yes. So we're coming live to the world with on my birthday. Yeah.
Congratulations on 3 years of sobriety earned one day at a time, Kylie. Mm-hmm. What is your primary recovery program or pathway to recovery?
I mix it up. So, I work in the space. 12 steps has been a huge assistance to me, but really a number of really understanding the neurology of addiction, kind of the family trauma work, being on the spiritual path in yoga, meditation, recovery coaching. So it is a bunch of different things. But 12 steps has certainly been a big part of my recovery.
Woman after my own heart, for sure, in that regard, starting with the 12 steps and then adding on to that as recovery has progressed. That's absolutely phenomenal. Last but certainly not least, what does recovery mean to you?
Recovery means building a life that I don't need to escape from. So it's certainly not just about putting down the drinks or the drug. It's around not needing to numb, dumb, and distract from daily life. So building a life that is intrinsically meaningful and purposeful, and also a lot of giving back. So it's very much a life of altruism as well.
Welcome, Way Out faithful and first timers, to this week's installment of the Way Out Podcast. We appreciate your ears. Our mission is simple: to bring you powerful recovery stories and recovery power topics so you can jumpstart or re-energize your recovery from alcoholism and addiction. The Way Out Podcast does not speak on behalf of, nor are we affiliated with, any 12-step organization. The Way Out Podcast partners with All Recovery Rings and allrecoveryrings.com, where you'll find stunning recovery rings made from your very own recovery coin. That's allrecoveryrings.com. The Way Out Podcast is a proud supporter of Transitions Daily. Would you like to join a free, anonymous online group that offers a daily topic email with popular recovery resources accompanied by a secret Facebook group for discussion? Go to dailyaaemails.com for more information about Transitions Daily. Don't forget to share dailyaaemails.com with friends, in meetings, and with sponsees in recovery. Make sure to check us out on the web at www.wayoutcast.com. There you can subscribe to ensure you get the latest episodes first on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Help us recover out loud by giving us a 5-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app. Your voice matters, so share your thoughts on recovery with us by calling us at 218-382-1960 or leaving a message with us on the Anchor app, available for Android and Apple. Someone, somewhere, needs to hear your share. Finally, a word of caution: this podcast may contain strong language and mature content. Listener discretion is advised. The Way Out Podcast is on right now. I'm Charlie, and in this edition of The Way Out, recovery coach, entrepreneur, in person and long-term recovery, Kylie Butler comes to us from Bali to share her journey to and through recovery to this point with a sagacity and intuitiveness that is at once unmistakably authentic and enlightening. Her knockdown, drag-out bout with alcoholism is rife with the hallmarks of a classic battle with addiction, not the least of which was trauma and a heavy dose of denial, which, as most of us know, doesn't feel like denial when we're in it. Her recovery journey is rooted in the 12 steps, infused with a distinctly Buddhist set of principles and practices, which very much focuses on living in a way that centers and prioritizes acceptance and letting go of that which causes us to struggle. For Kylie, recovery was first a process of addition by subtraction. Eliminate the alcohol and then begin practices that allow her to continue to let go of the thoughts, attitudes, and behaviors that cause suffering, while at the same time increasing serenity and overall well-being in mind, body, and spirit. Kylie and I dig into her whale of a recovery story, talk some serious spiritual and recovery truth, and reveal how her recovery practices evolved into an entire practice of recovery and life coaching, where she now helps others create a meaningful life by design. So listen up. Kylie Butler, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us here on the Way Out podcast. You are a recovery coach. You are an entrepreneur. You are a person in recovery yourself. I can't wait to dig into your recovery journey and talk about a meaningful life by design. But before we do any of that, why don't you take a moment to introduce yourself to the Way Out podcast audience? Tell us a little bit about yourself and we will get started.
Okay, wonderful. So firstly, thank you. Yeah, for having me as a guest on your beautiful podcast and, yeah, calling me from the past into the future and my current location. Yeah, we're just defying all kinds of universal laws there, right. to come to listen and yeah, to speak to your guests. So, yeah, where do I even begin? A little bit about me. So, I mean, what's pertinent to today's conversation? I am in recovery. I've been in recovery for about 6 years, 3 years sober. I was very resistant to get sober. I was really committed to drinking like a normal person. I went through numerous rehabs before I actually even, I was so far from a surrender. So it has been, but I see that as a huge gift because it meant that I had to go through deep levels of self-discovery and different aspects of my life and who I am. And I had to reach new lows that made me completely reassess, you know, the whole meaning of my existence. So, yeah, in recovery, I work in the field. I'm a recovery coach. I'm also a career coach. I've kind of transitioned from a corporate career in people and culture and HR to working one-on-one with people. And I live in Bali. My podcast and my life is all around a meaningful life by design. So a life built that has meaning and purpose and value that's built from intention. And that's a little bit about me, just the tip of the iceberg. I'm from Australia, if that wasn't already obvious.
I'm already in love with the accent. So you've already got me won over from the get-go. I love the intentionality that you're bringing into what you're practicing both in your life and in your coaching. And as you make that transition from the corporate career to working with people and bringing that mindful, intentional mindset, right? And as we have to add, by the way, podcast creator and host to the list. So you got a lot going on.
True.
A lot going on.
There's a lot going on. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what it was like for you growing up. Where did you grow up and what was growing up like for you?
So I grew up on the northern beaches of Sydney in Australia. So on kind of surface level, it looked really idyllic. You know, I grew up surfing, sailing, two beautiful, loving parents who are still together and married, a sister who I'm very close with who's 18 months apart, We divided our time between my parents are from the bush, so the country in Australia. So that kind of keeps us really grounded and down to earth. And I went to a private Catholic girls' school, add in some Catholic guilt to my recovery journey and being a recovering people pleaser. And really it was a great, you know, and then I traveled the world through. I worked in London. I lived in Italy. Really privileged, blessed upbringing and life. It was kind of, you know, and it wasn't until my 30s that I used to drink normally. I partied for a while. I had a series of different things. So I had an eating disorder for a while, work addiction for a while, but alcohol didn't really kick in for me until later in life when it became, technically an absolute shit show before I got sober.
You know, I'm also a recovering Catholic, and I say that in jest because I have all the respect of the world for any faith that
allows you. Absolutely. I've gone full circle in faith. Totally. Yeah, in terms of faith. Yeah.
Totally. But no doubt about it that being a Catholic is definitely a part of my story and a part of my recovery journey. And the Catholic Church today is a lot different than it was 20, 30 years ago.
This is true. And like, hey, I skipped a really important bit, you know, because we're talking kind of top line, what happened in childhood.
Yeah.
Top line on paper. It was amazing. What I learned when I started going, like, why do I drink to this point of actually needing a hospital detox? Like, my addiction is on the DSM-5, right at, like, absolute severe as it gets, you know? And I had to do this kind of deep dive, and I was in a rehab once writing about my childhood, and it's like, what's your earliest happy memory with your mom? And I'm like, 19. I didn't realize there was all this suppressed, like, I work in complex trauma, so lots of little T's. Lots and lots of little T's. My parents trying their best but not meeting my emotional needs. Me feeling lonely and unsafe. And so superficially, you know, it looks wonderful. I find myself in rehabs in these therapy sessions, and like there's trauma that other people had suffered, you know, gang rapes and stuff. And I was like, oh, what am I doing here? I didn't earn my chair for me to be have such a problem with alcohol and not have any of this really bad stuff. But what I've learned was, I was born as a highly, highly sensitive being, you know, which is a superpower. It's a blessing and a curse. I have compassion. I have intuition. I am who I am because of that. But it's definitely one of the things that made me very prone to addiction.
Indeed. And we've actually interviewed a couple of folks that have really revealed that as a fairly common theme around recovering addicts and alcoholics and people in long-term recovery as being a highly sensitive person. I view myself in that category.
Yeah.
And
it
definitely plays into it, right?
No, oh, it absolutely is. I mean, some of the latest research is there is no specific gene for alcoholism. The only one that they can trace it back to, this is Gabor Mate's work, is that it's being, you know, highly sensitive. And really, you know, addiction is, you know, the pathological self-soothing of a deep psychological wound. You know, there's some level of, there's some level of trauma there, whether it be the big T's or the little T's. But I love addicts and alcoholics because normally, because of genetic pairing, you have highly sensitive people who are creative and intelligent. Rehabs could be fun because of that. Like, my addict friends are fucking awesome.
Totally. Absolutely. Totally. And that's why we feel like we found our tribe, Kylie, when we finally join the recovery community, surrender this thing and start really starting to get well. That's why it feels so amazing. Like, we found our tribe. Like, wow, you felt like I felt, you thought like I thought, you did what I did and you got better. And that means maybe I can get better too. Like, I can relate to you on such an intimate and fundamental level. And, you know, Kylie, we've only been talking for like 12 minutes and I've already, you know, intimately related with like 100 things. Right. And that's what it's like when we talk to another person that is in recovery or on a recovery journey. Right. There's so much more that we have in common than that sets us apart. You mentioned a couple of times big T and little T. And I think I know what you mean. And I think you mean big trauma and little trauma. But maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So complex trauma, big T and little T. So complex trauma, it doesn't actually have to be, you know, the violence or the sexual abuse that we think it of, because trauma is in essence when the system is overwhelmed and unable to cope with the current situation. So no matter how severe that is on, you know, a kind of traditional scale. And little T, so little trauma events. And we say it's complex because it's repetitive. So if you've got a parent who is, you know, unable to show love to you, or is, if, you know, a lot of alcoholics and addicts come from alcoholic, addict households, and we think it's all, or dysfunctional families. I think, oh, they had it, but it's because the parents, you know, they felt unsafe because of the inconsistencies in the family home. You know, they never know how the parent's going to show up. So they're kind of on edge. Like, so these constant, you know, situations where they don't feel safe, where they don't, you know, they can't be vulnerable and invulnerable, where those core emotional needs aren't essentially met, so it's what happens to you and also what doesn't happen to you in terms of those fundamental needs being met when you're very young.
And not having the ability to meet those needs yourself and then end up having to resort to unhealthy coping mechanisms to meet those needs, to feel connected, to feel a sense of safety, to numb those feelings, to feel euphoria, all these things that drugs or alcohol or both can do for us that we could not do for ourselves, right? And in the beginning, it's amazing, right? In the beginning, it feels like
Found, it's a medicine. Right. Yeah, I found my medicine. Right. This works. Woo!
The answer, right. So, Kylie, do you remember the first time you drank and how that felt for you?
So, look, I always liked drinking and alcohol, but I didn't really, it didn't get really bad until my 30s. But I still always remember, like, I got a real buzz from booze, like just a few drinks in
that sense of ease and comfort.
That sense of ease. And then, you know, later on when I really started to kick into, the alcoholism, when my tolerance was increasing, it had to be more and more that I would drink that I would get to that happy space, right? You know, so it'd have to be a few wines and a shot, you know, like, but early on, I remember like half a glass of wine. When I was in my early 20s, I remember going out, I was in London, I'd be like, because I was very thin, and so I'd like to have about half a glass of wine. I'd be like, that just kind of eases happiness. Like, I've never had social anxiety and stuff, so I don't, there's a lot of reasons that I do. And this is something actually, because you've spoken to, you know, how, you know, in the fellowship we can all really relate, we think the same and that type of thing. And sometimes if we don't think the same, we can feel quite isolating. So there's some communities that have gone, no, like I wasn't an alcoholic from my first drink. And I was a high-functioning alcoholic. So, you know, I didn't have problems getting a lot of aspects of my life together. You know, there were lots of great things going on. So, I don't relate. But, yeah, those inner feelings and stuff, irrespective of our external circumstances, we can all, most of us can really relate to that.
And I actually think, Kylie, the things that we may not relate to can be as important as the things that we do relate to, because I think initially we might either be one way or the other. We might find all these things that we relate with and felt like, this is home, this is my tribe, I've come home. Or we may come into it and say, I didn't drink like that. I didn't use like that. I didn't lose that. I didn't lose that. I didn't experience that, right?
Yet. And I'm the perfect example of the yet as well. I sat in a rehab across from a girl. I was telling a story about my beautiful fiance who came to collect me from the rehab with flowers. And she's like, I used to have a man like that in my life, but I drank too much. He left me. I was looking at her, shaking my head. You sad fucker. That's never going to be me. Right. And it was. I've really had to humble a lot. I used to sit in meetings as well. I'd look around. I'm like, I'm the best dressed person in here, and I'm wearing activewear. I don't belong here. I don't drink like that. I'm launching a new business, you know? I was in such denial too,
My story. Yes. I remember coming in at 19 years old after a DWI and a nudge from the judge. And I remember specifically thinking, like, this program's really great for you people. And by the looks of you all, y'all need it. Okay. You need it. Okay. But that was just a phase. I'm good. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to walk out of this thing and I'm going to get my poop in a group. And, you know, you sorry SOBs are going to be sitting around this table for the rest of your lives. Right. And really, in reality, half of me really thought that way. And the other half of me was pretty jealous and envious that they had seemed to figure something out that I just couldn't get myself to. Like, I just couldn't get myself to surrender at that point. I just couldn't get myself to accept what I really deep down inside knew. Right.
Same. I remember waking up. I was in a rehab one night, and it was in the middle of the night, and I got up, you know, when you're that half that state, you kind of still tapped into your self-conscious, you're not quite awake. And I was denying vehemently every day that I needed to be there. I'd only had one kind of really bad binge at that stage. And I there was this feeling in the middle of the night, and I was like, I'm an alcoholic.
Mm.
But I was so tenacious in not surrendering. And what a gift that surrender and acceptance is, because that's something I can carry in all aspects of my life. I can hold on to stuff. I can be self-righteous. I can be angry. I can be indignant. Or I can just let go.
That's a repeatable, exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Once we make that big surrender, like I can surrender to other things too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's powerful.
You know, and, you know, it reminds me of the saying that everything an addict or an alcoholic lets go of has claw marks in it, right? And
okay, I don't think I've heard that one before. But yeah, but that makes total sense. Yeah.
But it's a practice and we can get better at it. Right?
Totally. It is. It's a spiritual practice.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So tell me, Kylie, how does it progress? And tell me about, get me to that moment where this thing turns from something that's that you're functioning with, that you're able to manage, quote, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
And when does it start to become unmanageable? And how do you realize that this thing's starting to become a little unmanageable?
Yeah. And it's so funny with the, you know, hindsight and understanding, like if I need to manage it, it's a problem.
Right.
You know, people who don't have a drinking problem. They're like, that's not a problem. Like they leave half a beer drunk, you know, like.
Like, and so, I've never had to manage, Kylie, how many like bananas I eat.
Totally.
I've never, ever in my life been like, I'm only going to have two.
Yeah, it's so true. So it's kind of, you know, I was in early mid-30s and there was a number of different things that was happening. So I was living in a house with my fiancé at the time and his stepdaughter, and bless her little cotton socks, she didn't accept me. I felt very lonely and very isolated. He travelled for work. My friends were all going off and having, this is all just the external circumstances, obviously. My friends were going off and having young children. I felt very alone and very isolated, just like I'd felt when I was young.
Mm.
And that's when I started using alcohol as a medication.
Mm.
So it wasn't just the party drug, because I'd always, you know, I'd kept it to, you know, only ever drinking on weekends, and my party behavior had been pretty bad, but I'd also compared myself to my peer group who partied really hard too.
Right.
You know, we do cocaine all weekend and that kind of fun stuff. And my sister, who was a lot more balanced, was like, you've got a problem. I was like, look at my friends. I'm fine. and I was still always showing up for Monday and earning good money.
So, right, we've got these lines that we draw, right, Kylie? As long as I don't do X, Y, and Z, I'm not an alcoholic. And I get to continue to drink.
Yeah. And I went to, how, you know, the general population and medical population don't understand, you know, the complex neurological condition that is addiction. I went to the doctor once and said, I'm getting this anxiety the morning after I drink. And she prescribed me Valium. Here you go. Have booze in a tablet form. Knock yourself out, hun.
Exactly.
You know, crazy. So, so that was then, and then, then I started having the odd morning drink, and I realized, like that anxiety that I was carrying all day that felt like I can't breathe, the morning drink took the edge off. So this is when my body was starting to get the actual, you know, physical addiction to alcohol, the really physical thing. So the real heart rate, sweaty palms, toe anxiety the next day. And I realized I didn't sit
going
through that all day. I was going through withdrawals. And so, then I realized that I could have the morning drink. And then what happened over the course of years was...
And before you go further, isn't that amazing when you cross that line, but then you're like, nothing blew up. Like, I didn't, like, you know, my house didn't explode, right? My life didn't completely explode or implode. So clearly it's probably okay to keep doing this. Right?
Yeah. And it's suicide in increments. You know, it's also like when it just, you know, reflecting on something as you discuss that, you know, that it didn't implode, you know, that analogy of the frog in boiling water.
Absolutely.
You know, that's so when the frog's in the water and the water boils slowly, have no idea just how bad it is until we kind of step and look back and go, oh my God.
And you get back and you're like, oh my gosh, that was really,
it was really hard. And you also, you speak to other alcoholics and addicts and they're like, yeah, we get it. Yeah, we all hid bottles under the bed. There was heaps of bottles of wine in the wardrobe. I used to put two, like when I'm coming in from the shopping, you have to put stuff between the wine bottles so they don't clink. Right. So you can get them in the house to hide them in the cupboard. Like the levels of denial are just insane. But so it was just this kind of escalating to like the morning drink. And then, there was kind of manageable periods where I'd not drink because I'm normally very healthy. So I exercise and I eat really well. And I actually like being sober. So there were periods where I just wouldn't drink and everything is fine. But I'd got that, you know, the addiction, the real, my body was, you know, just, and sometimes I explain it to
physical
people.
Physical dependency.
Physical dependency, absolutely. I explain it to people sometimes in terms of like, when I drink, when my body reaches a certain saturation of alcohol, that the frontal lobe is offline, so all consequences go out the window, that there's nothing stopping me. And I try to explain it to lay people and say, basically, look, imagine someone was holding you underwater and you had to get oxygen, you had to get to the top, so you do anything to get to the top. That was me once I had booze in me. I climbed out windows to get more vodka. I missed 2 weeks of work. You know, like drinking in my room, not brushing my hair. My hair was matted. Then I'd go back to my parents' house. There was this period where I'd not drink for a while. Then I'd start drinking slowly and I'd be able to manage it. Then one night I'd drink too much and I'd have to have a morning drink the next morning. And then once I started the morning drink, I'd go into work a few days with little bottles of vodka and stuff in my handbag to get through the day. Then it wasn't enough. I wasn't getting to that high or that happiness. So I'd start sculling vodka. And then the phone would be off. Then I was just in so much shame, I wanted to sleep. So I'd just be lying in bed with a bottle of vodka. My partner at the time used to travel a lot, so sometimes he'd be away 7 days at a time. So that was that I could go into these binges. I wouldn't answer my phone for a couple of days. Someone would come looking for me. They'd help me get sober. I'd claw my way back up. I was doing consulting work at the time too, so I'd say that I'd had gastro. How many times can people have gastro? Then I started saying that I had some depression and anxiety, which I did when I was in, like, not before I was drinking, but when I was going through the withdrawal. So I did a lot of home detoxes on like one or two Valiums where your whole body is aching, auditory and visual hallucinations, like really, really dark, really dark. And, you know, and it was still my medicine. And because I had these periods where I could stay sober and I could drink like a normal person, I refused to accept. I was like, I believe in neuroplasticity. I can change the wiring of my brain. You know, like I was looking for any answer. I tried everything. It's kind of textbook, isn't it? And and I went to rehab multiple times. And it wasn't till 3 years ago that I was in hospital after another relapse. And I was lying in the bed, valiumed up to the eyeballs because they were trying to bring me out of the withdrawal and my heart rate was still through the roof. You know, I was so shaky and they're like, you're not even responding to the valium because you develop a tolerance to the drugs that help you withdraw safely.
Right.
You know? And so, pretty dire stuff. There's someone who drinks spirulina and kale smoothies and, you know, and talks about living it. So I'm also living outside of my values. So the shame is just toxic. So there was that last time I got confused. I was like, I think my family are not coming. I think they've left. Oh, we also skipped my ex-fiance leaving me saying, shortly before our wedding, saying he's like, I can't watch the woman I love kill herself in front of me.
Wow.
It was really dark. We're now very good friends and things all blew up for a reason. I love the life that I live now, kind of the self-actualization degree of and the external circumstances. But, yeah, it really took me to some absolute lows, you know. And I wish I'd – not that I'd necessarily change anything because I am who I am because of all of those events and all of those missteps. And I think all the mistakes that were made on me in when I was in rehab make me a much better recovery coach. But it was still, I didn't understand early on what I was really dealing with. I didn't understand that I'd crossed that invisible line that I was never going back to normal drinking. And I don't know, I would have been able to hear it then, but it's a tough road, isn't it? Like, it really is.
What was different about the time that you surrendered than the other times?
Good call. Like, there was also the evidence I could not deny. The last three times, so I had a few months up in sobriety. So I had kind of 3 months up, and then I had 6 months up. And the last time I relapsed, I'd actually wanted to get sober. I hadn't been this, oh yeah, I'm just having a 3 month gap. Because I'd had a few other stints and they were just gaps. So this time I was like, no, I really want to get sober. And I'd just been in a lot of emotional pain after a breakup, and I'd gone and drunk, and I'd lied to myself that I was going to be okay. And the last three times that I'd gone out, I'd got a few drinks. I'd gone back to a bottle of vodka a day within a day. There was just no denying. There was no manageability, zero, And when I'd also got those chunks up, then I realized my life was better without booze. And I literally, there was no, I knew in my soul, and I know people say that it's get the head to the heart, So there was the denial, it was just, the evidence was all there. There was no way. My denial didn't have anything to hang on to anymore. The low was so low, and the fear of losing the ones that I love, and also seeing the amount of pain that I caused. There's so much selfishness in addiction. Like, I know I was suffering, and I want to be compassionate and kind to that, that the inner child and the woman who was in so much pain that she needed to do that. But also the pain that I was causing to the people that I loved was just watching your dad cry beside the hospital bed, having your fiance visit you in rehab. It's tough. My little niece is seeing me absolutely sideways. And there was just a point where I don't care. I'm not doing this anymore.
It sounds like you had this radical self-honesty.
Yeah.
Combined with a realization that everything that you had tried before to manage it didn't work. With then some willingness, some genuine willingness to want to get better.
Yeah. So, and you're absolutely right, because my last kind of two little stints, I used to joke and say I'm the relapse queen, but the reality is, I wasn't actually trying to get sober. I was just trying to manage it, So really there's been two relapses since I've actually given it a decent shot. Right. And since I've committed, touch wood, I haven't gone back to that drug of choice. There's still addictive patterns in my life. Yeah, love a bit of validation. Sugar's a real go-to,
and that's a process. Yeah. It's a journey, right, Kylie? First for me, it was drugs and alcohol, and then it was nicotine. And then, I had a fairly recent reckoning with sugar, right? It's a process. Porn,
yeah,
it's a process, that we recognize that there's these addictive behaviors that have the exact same DNA
Exactly. You're escaping yourself. You're getting a hit. You're getting a hit of, dopamine or, whatever.
I'm getting that euphoric dopamine hit while I'm numbing and escaping reality and feelings.
Yep, totally.
Right. Yeah. And there's a lot of ways to do that. It really sounds like you experienced much of what I experienced in my active alcoholism and addiction, which was the can't continue to use, can't quit dynamic, where over any period of time, my use would become unmanageable. But alternately, over any period of time, I couldn't be sober without a solution because that too would become unmanageable. So I found myself in this can't use, can't quit, rock at a hard place scenario. Can you relate to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I can. I was fortunate also that, you know, when I put down the drink, you know, I was already on the personal development and spiritual journey. So I did have some other tools and, you know, I went and spent a lot of money on a psychologist once and we did all these sessions. He said, and he's like, look, honestly, your mental health is great. The only problem is you have a really severe alcohol addiction. And that wasn't technically true. There's still, you know, I was still self-soothing with alcohol and there was still stuff to work through. And that's a lifetime journey. But yeah, absolutely. I really don't. I think if we truly put down not just the drink or the drug, but try and put down addictive behaviors, then we need a solution to be able to manage, you know, our emotions and our sensitivity and what was driving us to drink. And I see, I am a big advocate of 12 steps, but I don't see it as the only solution, because I see a lot of people who are unwell thinking just more meetings is going to get them better. And that's not dealing with the reason they went to drink.
Oh, I want to talk more about that. Yes.
Clinical psychologists, yes, or, you know, all yes, other methodologies are really important.
Absolutely. I want to talk way more about the solution and the array of methodologies and pathways we can avail us to in just a minute. One of the things that, you know, that I want to touch on is this idea that, and it sounds like you might be in this place, that we can give ourselves grace for using and abusing substances and behaviors prior to getting into recovery. Because let's be honest, we didn't have any other tools or coping mechanisms at that time. We really honestly were doing the best we could with what we had at the time. Right.
Yeah.
And it did get us through. And let's also be honest, it worked until it didn't. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So this idea that we need to have all this shame and, you know, regret and around how much and how regularly we went into excess around substances and behaviors, it's all hogwash, because, you know, ultimately we were just trying to survive, right?
Absolutely.
Tell me more about the solution that ended up working for you. You said, you know, you talk about the 12 steps, and so talk about your 12-step journey and then tell me about what else worked for you as you progressed through your recovery journey.
Yeah, sure. So 12 steps are really, you know, I did have a spiritual belief and it wasn't, you know, rooted in Catholicism anymore, but I certainly did believe in a higher power. I had to kind of, I struggled with the very masculine kind of format and structure and dogma of 12 steps. The idea that, you know, my defects of character can be handed over to a man in the sky. There were aspects of it. But when I realized it was actually around surrender, acceptance, taking self-responsibility, owning my shit, becoming a better person and helping others, then it became, it's like, why was I pushing back on this, you know? So, you know, I am, and the amazing community. So a big part is, you know, the 12 steps, the community, finding some rock stars within that community that really worked. I worked with a Buddhist there. I also do 8-step Buddhist recovery, which I was already on the Buddhist path. So this has actually been amazing because it's helped me commit to my Buddhist studies by having a regular meeting and, you know, reading through literature. I had a Buddhist therapist early on who was incredibly helpful. A clinical psychologist who's an expert in the neuroscience of mental health and complex trauma was really the psychologist who got me over the line in sobriety and helped me reduce a lot of that shame. So I've done quite a bit of work around shame and the inner child. So really understanding that it's complex, understanding how I need to be in tribe and having that social connection. So there's been a lot of different paths to understanding who I am, without, you know, without that shame as well, learning more kindness and compassion and empathy. So yeah, there's the 12 steps, there's the Buddhist 8 steps, there's traditional psychotherapy, there's coaches. I'm generally working with someone. I think you can always improve. There's healers. There's some other stuff that I don't know that I get open here, but let's just say alternate medicines well, that I really think are incredibly important. I personally think, you know, psychedelics can have a place to play in addiction. I'm very open-minded to all the all alternate therapies. I don't think any in isolation. I don't think yoga or meditation or, you know, just going to ayahuasca is going to fix you. I don't think there's any magic pill. Mm. But I think a combination of different things along our journey can be very, very helpful.
You know, a number of things that you said that I think are really instructive, and that number one, I love the simplification of the 12-step program and that, you know, there's universal principles that are embodied in the 12-step program that are of a spiritual nature that allow us to be able to recover, right? Mm-hmm. When we embrace these spiritual principles of self-honesty and surrender and, perseverance and, reconciliation, all these spiritual principles that we're embarking on when we do this really important 12-step work. I love this concept of the 8-step Buddhist program. So we'll definitely have a link to that, as well as obviously all of Kylie's information as well. But the 8-step Buddhist program, I'm actually myself in the middle of some Buddhist meditation training, and I've been meditating for, you know, about a year and a half, but now I'm embarking on a more formal Buddhist meditation training, which I'm just profoundly amazed by, and it's really starting to change how I meditate and really change other things too, right?
But we get those neurons firing harmoniously. I mean, as a recovery coach in complex trauma, mindfulness is one of the cognitive behavioral therapy and other approaches, but mindfulness that relationship we have to our mind and our emotions and our feelings, the practice of meditation is so powerful in recovery. I can't actually, to be honest, the people who do it without, that must be hard.
Well, it's like anything.
That's up to them.
I agree. I think back now in my early recovery, like how did I get by without meditation? And it is a practice. So I'm glad that you used that word, because we're not good at it in the beginning and we have to practice it.
Yeah. And if we go back to the principles we're saying that we learn, and we learn on the experiential felt level of the acceptance and surrender, like with meditation, you know, it's neither good nor bad. It's whether we can accept it. So yes, we can say the good on the kind of traditional scale of, you know, can I find some serenity and peace, and can I come back to my breath? But I know that even if I have a crazy, crazy monkey mind, but I can be in acceptance of my monkey mind, then for me, that's a good meditation. You know, like ideally I'd like to be going to a stage of, oh, I can just get to a place of Zen even quicker and more Zen-like, and the Zen that lasts for longer. And that would be lovely. But yeah, sometimes the experience is just being okay with my mind being pretty crazy. And that's what the, you know, part of the 12 steps, what we learn, you know, the
that acceptance.
Yeah.
Yes.
Acceptance of what is, because struggle in essence is whenever we don't accept or surrender our current circumstances, past, present, or future. If I am resisting and wrestling with, I don't want the weather to be rainy today. I want my sound to be better. But if I'm just okay with the fact that only one of my earphones is working right now, then it's okay. It's only my relationship to that situation, not the actual situation. The dog barking's not the problem. The problem is that I have a problem with the dog barking.
That's right. The problem is that the emotional response that is triggered within me that I have a problem managing and dealing with and accepting.
Yes.
And I'm mad that this, and I'm not accepting that this is the way it should be. It should be in a different way, just like in meditation. And that's why I think it's so beneficial that you said, even if I have this crazy hamster wheel, like I like to call it the itty bitty city committee going on in my head, right? I could accept that instead of trying to add 25 more minutes to my meditation until I sort of try to like will myself into some sort of like, you know, artificially created Buddha-like Zen moment, state. Right? Like, you know, which is some sort of weird, sick punishment that I'm inflicting upon myself. Like, you're going to get there. Dang it. Right.
Yeah,
I could just be at the end and I could accept it. And I could say, you know what, this is what it is. And that's
yes,
okay.
Totally. Like I've done a Vipassana meditation before, so I'm familiar with that, but they got like a 10-day silent meditation retreat. And there are aspects of that where it feels like it's a marathon. And I've heard about people doing it who are sweating because they're kind of literally hanging onto their chairs to get good at meditation. You know?
The one
damn,
other
I'm
thing-
gonna do this. I'm gonna beat my mind.
One way or the other. The other thing that you brought up, which I think is so important to highlight, is that indeed therapy or some sort of mental health, professional mental health, can be transformational for us. And indeed, in my own recovery journey, therapy was absolutely transformational for me. And I absolutely believe to the fiber of my being that I would not be sober today if I didn't embark on a recovery journey, a program of recovery, and therapy simultaneously.
I'm with you. Yep. 1,000%.
And those who may tell you that you don't need anything else besides, you know, a 12-step program or a faith-based program or whatnot, maybe for them, maybe, right? But I think for a lot of us...
it doesn't deal with complex trauma, which is the root of addiction.
Right. Yeah. But I do think for a lot of us, Kylie, therapy can be a critical piece of the puzzle in terms of getting well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can also, like I see some people who don't believe in anything else and, you know, each to their own. And as I'm saying this, I'm like, oh, I'm trying not to be judgy, but it kind of sounds judgy. But regardless, I'll plow on. I see people who are very resistant to anything outside 12 steps and they're managing their sobriety like they were managing their drinking. It's really tough. Like they have to do the breath work, they have to do the meditation, you know, their life has to be a certain set of circumstances at a certain control, and they need to do a meeting every day or they're not traveling okay.
Right.
Like there's a few people I can think of, and this is not obviously for everyone, but there are some people who you can see that they're not okay, you know, and they're just keeping their head above water with meetings, and it doesn't have to be that tough.
Right. It doesn't have to be a struggle.
You don't have to be struggling. And you can, well, of course, we're always going to have aspects of struggle in our life. That's just reality of being human. You know, ticket to ride in this lifetime is pain and struggle, you know, but we can lessen it. It doesn't have to be that hard.
The work that you're doing now, Kylie, tell us a little bit about that. You're a recovery coach and an entrepreneur and a life coach and a podcast creator and host. Tell us what that is like, what life is like, it thriving, I dare say, in recovery.
So, I mean, because everything was blowing up, you know, like I started again, and I started very intentionally building a life that is meaningful and purposeful and aligned to my values. So, you know, I live in Bali. I'm surrounded by amazing people I have deep, heartfelt connections with. The work that I do, I really love. You know, my background was in human resources, then into a specific area called the employee value proposition, which is a kind of where HR and marketing kind of intersect. And You know, so I was, prior to the crisis, I was balancing consulting gigs with coaching work, which I'll move into talking about in a second. And then since the crisis, I've done more study as well and ramped up the coaching work and the recovery coaching work. And so with the recovery coaching, I've got studies in complex trauma, worked under an expert in the neuroscience of mental health, and have, you know, addiction certifications as well. And so what my days look like now is, so when I moved out of HR, I was then trained as a coach and I became a career coach. So that was all about purposeful living, designed on how do you bring your unique gifts to the world in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. So helping people understand who they are and curating and creating a life that they love. There's some other, I've got five different websites. So I've gone from ideation to digital execution, so I can help both entrepreneurs and intrapreneurs in their career journey. So my time at the moment is split with career coaching and recovery coaching. So recovery coaching, complex trauma, addiction to alcoholism. I also work with sex addicts. So I do one-on-one Skype sessions globally. And I've done a couple of group programs and online programs. I'm going to do more of those. And with A Meaningful Life by Design, which is the podcast, which is all around having people on the program who have intentional, meaningful lives and have done interesting things with their lives and faced some challenges, and for them sharing their journey and inspiring and empowering others through sharing their story.
Tremendous work you're doing, Kylie, and I'm a huge fan of all of what you're doing currently, especially the recovery coaching. I am in the middle of my own recovery coach training, and so this is a new journey I'm embarking upon myself, which is scary and really, really, really exciting for me as well. Mm-hmm. So I love being able to connect with you on that recovery coaching aspect, because it's important work. And I think it can be a critical cog in the recovery pathway for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I've got, Kylie, some rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
Sure.
For some rapid fire questions.
I'm ready and willing.
Number one, what does your daily or regular recovery routine consist of?
Ah, amazing question. So very big on a miracle mornings type routine. So always some meditation, visualization, exercise, first thing in the morning. So yeah, eyes open, meditation, could be yoga, could be going for a walk in nature, could be the gym, plus the meditation. I'm getting really clear on what my intentions are for that day. Then yeah, I do, a meeting every few days, either Buddhist 8-step or another 12-step. And then in my work, there's a lot of recovery in that. Nice. So in working with others, and always make myself available for, anyone who needs. I post a lot and write a lot on social media around addiction, so make myself available for anyone who's struggling to reach out and have a chat.
I'm a huge recovery routine nerd, and meditation is a huge part of mine, and just having that daily routine, I think, is so important. And you've got
eating well, sleeping well, sleep hygiene.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. Sleep is so important. And so is exercise and activity. I love it. What book or piece of recovery literature had the biggest impact on your recovery?
Ooh, one book? One book, okay. Taming the Tiger, which is a book around Buddhist practices for daily life and meditation, which I picked up many, many years ago when I started my spiritual journey traveling in Southeast Asia, but I picked it up again when I was in recovery. So there are lots and lots. I mean, Healing the Shame That Binds You, there's lots, but that would be the number one.
And it's the first on this podcast that we've heard that book, so I love that. And we will definitely have that in the show notes. What is the best piece of advice you received in your recovery?
It would be around understanding complex trauma. And the question I need to ask myself is not what's wrong with me, it's what's happened to me.
Ah, I love that.
So I can go back, understand that, drop the shame, and just move forward. I'm not broken, you know, I'm not fucked up. Just some shit went down and I need to deal with that.
What is the greatest challenge you've had in your recovery to date?
The greatest challenge would be managing heartache and anxiety. Without, I don't even think of going to a drink anymore, but certainly in early sobriety, you know, anything around, I have an anxious attachment style and some abandonment trauma. So dealing with relationships and heartache without being able to go to a drink used to be really hard.
Those could be huge triggers, because unmanageable and overwhelming emotions are really the whole thing, right?
Yeah, in absolute fear and anxiety.
Mm. What is your greatest success in recovery?
I didn't know that it's about the year. I think I could say the year count because I'm sitting at three years.
Right.
I mean, it's mostly 5 years sober, but in terms of continuous daily sober, it's three. The biggest success. Yeah, just I think it goes back to like the biggest challenge, being able to manage through heartache, fear, and anxiety without picking up a drink.
That is the whole ball game, if you ask me.
It is. It is. Yeah.
Kylie, what song symbolizes your recovery?
You know what? I've never thought as one song, but there was a song that they used to play in rehab, and I listened, put it on in a ceremony, a little personal ritual ceremony not so long ago. That Frozen song, Let It Go.
Yes.
That one from the animation, from the animated movie.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, you know, that's not very kind of you, Kylie, because, you know, we make a commitment to listen to that song as we're putting together the episode. So, you know, that's only going to be stuck in my head for the next 60 days, I'm sure. but it's a great song, and it's actually very recovery related. I actually wonder if the person who wrote Frozen and wrote that song was in recovery, because it's
there are so many books and movies and songs, and you get into it, you're like, they're a 12 stepper.
Totally.
So many. Yeah. Yeah.
We know so many one when we see one.
Yes. Totally. Totally.
Now, this one's a doozy.
It's almost like you have this wink when you see people out.
I know. Yeah. Well, there's got to be a secret, you know, a sign, you know.
Yes.
Like, yes. Yeah, like people who drive Jeeps, like, you know, have a secret handshake. Same thing with people in race. This last one's a bit of a doozy, but important nonetheless. What is something you haven't forgiven yourself or someone else for?
Ooh. I haven't forgiven myself for current, you know, other addictive behaviors. So, you know, binging on sugar, just trying to find a way outside of myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel that. I feel that big time, Kylie. Before we sign off, is that a rooster in the background?
it's such a lie that roosters only go off in the morning. These pesky buggers start at about 10 to 6 and they go through to midnight. Yeah, lots of roosters.
That's awesome. I'm
in an area near the beach here in Bali where it's quite rural.
Yeah.
And it's near a surfing community, and there's lots of roosters.
That's tremendous. That's absolutely tremendous. Kylie, I can't thank you enough for taking time to be with us today and sharing your recovery journey with us. It's been a true pleasure having you on the Way Out podcast. If you want any of Kylie's contact information, learn about her podcast, her recovery coaching work, I will have all of her links in the show notes. So check the show notes right now and it'll all be there, along with her book recommendation, the link to the song from Frozen, if you can't find it, but I'm going to put a link in there for you just to make it easy. Kylie, thanks again for being on the Way Out podcast.
Oh, no, thank you. It's been such a pleasure, an absolute joy.
And thank you, everybody out there in Way Out podcast land. We will talk to you next time. Thank you for being a part of the Way Out. We appreciate your ears. We're sharing powerful recovery stories and recovery power topics every week, so keep listening up. If you would like to reach out to the show, you can visit us on the web at wayoutcast.com. That's wayoutcast, all one word, .com. There you can subscribe to the Way Out podcast on all of the major podcast aggregators, such as iTunes, CastBox, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podbean, Overcast, and more. Or simply drop your hosts a friendly email at share@wayoutcast.com. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the show, contact us at share@wayoutcast.com. See you next time, and remember, if you don't change, your sobriety date will.